Good morning. May it please the Court, Joel Nichols for the petitioner appellant Erica Rickman. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes both for rebuttal and for addressing any additional questions the Court may have. We're here today asking the Court to remand this case for trial. The Supreme Court found that Ms. Rickman, quote, presented sufficient evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact on the prima facie elements of her claim, end quote. And they remanded this case to the Court only to address the additional legal issue of overriding justification.
Well, in this case, trying to get an idea if we have an agreement between the parties of what our charge is on remand here, do you take that to mean that we're to review causation?
No.
The sent back, or what do you take the Supreme Court's direction to be?
No, Your Honor, I take that direction to be the issue of overriding justification, because that was also a basis on which the trial court granted summary judgment.
Well, even though the trial court didn't, well, or I guess summarily address causation, the trial court did address both. And the Supreme Court addresses both causation and the question of the overriding justification. So the Supreme Court says, don't conflate these are separate. And in the briefing, the parties dispute whether there are material issues of fact as to causation. So based on the Supreme Court case and the briefing, it appears as though causation is an issue in dispute, and that is something that we should address.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that causation is an issue in dispute. I disagree that it's something that the Supreme Court has directed Division I to address. The Supreme Court has said that Ms. Rickman established prima facie elements to create a genuine issue of material fact on all elements of her claim of the tort of wrongful discharge in violation of public policy, and specifically only remanded the case to this court to address absence or overriding justification.
I don't think it's that clear. I mean, in the first case, we did not reach the issues of adequacy of the justification or causation. And the Supreme Court says remand to address the issues that weren't addressed before. So your argument, I understand, is, well, let's just look at this one part of the decision where the court says you have established this. But I don't see our job or the direction as just adequacy of justification.
I believe the Supreme Court, if they thought that causation was an issue that they wanted the court to address, they would have said that, and they
didn't. Well, they did talk about causation, and they specifically said we remand to address the issues that weren't addressed before. So we have that at the trial court level. And that's where we start, and certainly Judge Ellis did address all of this, including causation.
She did, although.
So perhaps you could move on to what you think the material issues of fact are as to causation.
So I can certainly address that. The respondent and I disagree about the degree to which Judge Ellis addressed the causation issue.
Well, that aside, what are the material issues of fact?
But that aside, the material issues of fact are the person to whom Ms. Rickman complained about the health insurance privacy violations is the same actor, the same person who terminated her. There are conflicting reasons for termination that the employer offered from two different witnesses: conflict of interest versus lack of integrity and poor judgment. Ms. Rickman was open about her son's relationship. We established that it was common knowledge at the company, and she didn't show any favoritism to him. She raised her risk bucketing concern earlier than the respondent alleges she did. The proximity of her raising her concerns about health insurance privacy violations and her termination is circumstantial evidence of
And proximity, by that do you mean timing, and you're referring to the Wilmot case?
Correct. The specious nature of Mr. Lopez's conflict of interest complaint, the respondent's admission, then denial regarding the legality of the risk bucketing practice on which Ms. Rickman complained, and also Mr. Grover's suspect concerns about Ms. Rickman's business capabilities. There's one more, the Vanessa Lopez complaint. There's a dispute about how much of a role that played or whether or not Ms. Rickman showed any lack of integrity or poor judgment in being involved in the decision for terminating Ms. Lopez's employment. And so there's this whole host of factual issues that are really not appropriate to be resolved at the summary judgment level that should be tried to a jury. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Skylar Sherwood on behalf of the respondent, Premier Blue Cross, in this appeal. Well, we're back again here.
The Supreme Court gave three directions as to what was to happen when this case came back. First, it said we remand for the Court of Appeals to address Primera's alternate argument for upholding the trial court's order of dismissal. Later, it said we remand to the Court of Appeals to consider the alternate ground for the trial court's order of dismissal. And then even later than that, it said we remand for the Court of Appeals to address whether the trial court's order of summary judgment should be affirmed on the alternate ground that Primera met its burden of proof that it had an overriding justification for Rickman's discharge. The first two statements appear to be referencing the causation argument that was presented in the trial court and not addressed in our first opinion. The third statement appears, by the language it uses, to be discussing something else, but not something that appears to be at issue in this case. So we're just trying to get an idea up front. What do the parties expect to read about
right
when they get an opinion from the court?
Like this.
Yeah.
Right. And you've touched on, really, I think, the crux here. And from Premier's position, I mean, obviously, Ms. Rickman is advancing an argument that the absence of justification element is an affirmative defense. It only applies where an employer has conceded or otherwise sort of agrees that it's fired somebody for public policy-linked conduct.
As in Gardner, right.
Obviously, that's not this case. Those aren't our facts.
So should we be addressing both that and causation?
So I think there's two.
No one wants you people to be here a third time, right?
Well,
so, I mean, we're trying to get a handle. There was a motion for reconsideration, which resulted in the striking of case citations, but not a rewording of the direction, which is what I think the parties were seeking to gain in the motion for reconsideration. So.
Exactly that point. So given the opportunity to take on this argument from Ms. Rickman in her motion for reconsideration, the court declined to do so. And so what we have is if they viewed, which they knew the trial court's rationale under the absence of justification element amounted essentially in substance to a causation argument. So if the court is, in their opinion, saying this is an affirmative defense, then there'd be no reason to remand to this court because they could have determined as a matter of law that that analysis was improper. And so I think we need to take the Supreme Court's opinion at face value, which is, as Your Honor recited, review the trial court's alternative ground for granting summary judgment, which is review the absence of justification element, which is how we end up at, in essence, a causation element because the court refers to things such as pretext and temporal proximity, things that fall more under the auspices of causation. So from Premier's standpoint, this court could perhaps defer on a straightforward decision as to whether this is an affirmative defense by simply addressing at face value what the trial court's analysis was of the absence of justification element below. And so when we do that...
Do you agree or disagree with the proposition that the overriding justification defense discussed in Gardner is different from the causation burden in the prima facie case?
I think that it's not clear how the absence of justification element should work in all cases. Our single example of that in the case law is the Gardner case.
Where the employer says, I absolutely agree with Mr. Gardner. We fired him. We fired him for those reasons. We got no dispute about any of that, but we have an overriding justification for doing so because he's an armored car driver and he puts people in danger when he acts inconsistent with our rules.
Right. I mean, there's a unity between the conduct
is that
the
notion
employer's
present here
on.
Anywhere?
And that's not the case here. But I will say the case law other than Gardner and I think Gardner is really the only case that discusses this element in any particular amount of detail. The other cases, public policy cases, discuss it and seem to frame it as the absence of justification element is the employer's opportunity to counter the plaintiff's assertion that they were in fact fired for this public policy conduct. And so that does, at least in this case, involve some amount of causation analysis. And that seems to be how it's postured in other cases besides Gardner. If we can admit that Gardner pertains to a particular set of circumstances, it may not be that that's the only set of circumstances that the absence of justification element works within, but that it can take these other forms that, you know, other cases in the public policy case law have postured this particular element as being, or as at least as an open door for an employer to then put forth its evidence of why, what its justification is for why it terminated
in the arena of discrimination law. And I think this was argued in the motion for reconsideration. It's analogous to a BFOQ, a bona fide.
Yes, if the
justification, they analogize the justification in the wrongful termination case law
right.
to, in the discrimination case law, a BFOQ, which is the burden is on the employer.
Right. There was discrimination, but we had a good reason
right.
for it.
Right. I mean, that was the analogy. But again, that was in the motion to reconsider, as I understand.
That, and so you're absolutely right, Your Honor. I come back to if that's the analysis that the Supreme Court intended for this element to take, this remand would not be necessary because they could have decided as a matter of law. Very clearly, the trial court did not use that analysis.
Right.
They could have decided as a matter of law it was in error, and we're going to remand to the trial court.
Because overriding justification is not a factual question for the jury.
Right.
It's a legal
correct.
Question. Right? Okay.
Well,
did you anywhere in the trial court litigation claim that you had an overriding justification in the sense that it's addressed in Gardner?
No,
sir. In other words, we admit what is being claimed by the plaintiff, but we had this justification for it, a la Gardner.
No, sir, because, of course, Premiera has been consistent in its explanation for its dismissal of Ms. Rickman, which was the results of the ethics investigation that showed her lack of judgment and lack of integrity in not only decisions that she had made, but her course of conduct during that investigation.
And you see those going to the prima facie case?
That's a legitimate business reason that was articulated.
And so in this case, I think there is a causation aspect to the absence of justification element. Again, if we look at it as the case law in the public policy realm, aside from Gardner, has talked about it, which is now it's the employer's opportunity to provide its justification for why it dismissed the plaintiff, when the plaintiff is saying it's
which
because
is analogous,
of public.
Which is analogous to a legitimate
it
business
is.
Reason. And then the question is pretext.
It is pretext. And here, Premier's stance is that given the substantial undisputed evidence of Ms. Rickman's lack of judgment and her lack of integrity that was gathered during the investigation, no reasonable jury could conclude that there's a causal link between her complaint. And that evidence takes various forms. One piece of evidence is the fact that the complaint was made by Stephen Lopez, who was disinterested in all of this. The investigation corroborated aspects, many aspects of his complaint separately from third parties. I'm sorry, my time is up. I lost track of that time. But in the end, Your Honors, if we take the trial court's rationale and assessment of the absence of justification element at its face, it amounts to causation. Premier's stance on that is that no reasonable trier of fact, based on the substantial undisputed evidence, could conclude there was causation here, and therefore summary judgment could be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honors, I think that part of the confusion between and the conflation between overriding justification and causation is the fact that overriding justification is an element of the Parrott test, not an element of the tort of wrongful discharge in violation of public policy, which causation is. That's an element of the tort. And as Justice Fairhurst pointed out, Ms. Rickman is a whistleblower, and she falls into one of these four traditional categories of wrongful discharge in violation of public policy, and the Supreme Court has said, therefore, you don't get into the Parrott analysis. Parrott is only helpful as a paradigm if the case doesn't fall into one of those four categories. So,
and that is entirely helpful when we read that. Can you explain to me why that's in a concurrence instead of in the court's opinion?
I cannot. I cannot, other than the fact that Ms. Rickman raised her concerns prior to a law violation versus after. I think that's a distinction without a difference. I mean, she complained, what kind of behavior do we want to encourage? We want to encourage people to come forward before the employer violates the law. I don't think that determines whether she's a whistleblower.
We wrestle with the three different versions of the remand instruction in your case and in the two other cases that were decided on purportedly the same issue, purportedly to clarify things for us, and then trying to cobble together from the multiple non-majority opinions in the various others. So you're exactly right when you say what Justice Fairhurst said. And I think that Justice Fairhurst is exactly right in saying it. I can't get my arms around why it's not in a majority opinion, any of the three, and why it's in a concurring opinion, which would have made our discussion here today different in terms of what we likely would have been talking about. And I'm gathering that you don't have any insight for me that's going to be my Damascus moment. Where is
it going to? I'm equally nonplussed.
Okay.
All right. And as far as the causation issue goes, I disagree again with the respondent on the characterization that there's a ton of undisputed evidence here. I believe it is largely disputed. There's substantial disputed evidence. Stephen Lopez, for example, was an interested party. He was a family friend. And he was disgruntled, and he didn't like Ms. Rickman's son.
Let me ask you this. Is this the same as if it was a race discrimination case, where your burden would be to show that that the nefarious reason was a reason, not the only reason.
Well,
is that the same here?
Well, it is similar. Under the Scrivener case now, we know that one way of showing pretext is to show that a substantial factor was the illegal reason. But the court has now said that's only one way of showing pretext. We're not even limited to that. Ultimately, it's
well,
a jury
either,
issue.
You can either offer evidence that directly rebuts their evidence or offer evidence that shows that even if their evidence were true, your evidence still shows that it could be the nefarious reason could still be a substantial factor.
Correct, but ultimately it's a jury question.
And your position is there are material questions of fact on each of those things?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.